What I Believe was the title of two separate essays by the philosopher Bertrand Russell and the novelist E.M. Forster in the early 20th century. These two humanist activists set out their approach to life, their fundamental worldview, in a way that was accessible to all. I'm Andrew Copson, Chief Exec of Humanists UK, and in this podcast I'm talking to humanists today about what they believe, to understand more about the values, convictions and opinions they live by.
Hello there. I'm Alice Roberts. I'm Vice President of Humanists UK, and you've found your way to this fantastic humanist podcast. So I'm thinking you might be interested in finding out a little bit more about Humanists UK, which is the national charity working on behalf of non-religious people to advance free thinking, to combat discrimination against non-religious people, and also promote generally a fairer, more tolerant society. If you'd like to support the podcast or find out more about the humanist approach to life and all the work of Humanists UK, please visit the website. It's easy to find if you just search for humanists.uk. If you like what you see there, please consider joining us as a member. I'll let you get back to the podcast.
Lynn Featherston is a Liberal Democrat member of the House of Lords. She was a member of Parliament for Hornsey and Wood Green between 2005 and 2015, and in the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition, she played a major role in the passing of the Same-Sex Marriage Act in 2013, working closely on the campaign with many organisations, including the Coalition for Equal Marriage and Humanists UK itself. She's also a patron of Humanists UK. Lynn Featherston, thank you for joining us on What I Believe.
Pleasure.
I thought we'd start with something very specific. You were the architect when you were in government of equal marriage. So I thought we'd start from there, because rereading some of the speeches and articles you made at the time and recently on the anniversary, 10-year anniversary of equal marriage, you talked about equality. So I'm guessing equality is an important value to you.
Yeah, it absolutely is in many, many ways, you know. It's not equality per se, but it's fighting against the injustice of inequality. Mm. I mean, I don't think everyone should be exactly the same. I mean, that would be the opposite side of me, which doesn't believe in conformity and wants creativity. But it does mean that everyone has legal rights to the same thing. And so, because, I mean, yes, I think a lot of people think I'm gay because I architected same-sex marriage.
And was such a passionate advocate of it.
Yes, because it's completely, when Labour took that immense step forward with civil partnerships, without which I could not have done what I did 13 years later with equal marriage, I thought it was fantastic, but it always stuck in my head that it wasn't equal. It was a bit sort of Animal Farm, more equal than others.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it's the injustice of inequality. That's an interesting way of putting it, maybe a very liberal way of putting it, but we'll come on to that later. But the injustice of inequality, so it's that implies really it's the injustice that you're opposed to.
Yes, because it's the luck of the draw, isn't it? I mean, I was born to, I'm an immigrant, child of immigrants or grandparent immigrants, like most of the people in this country. And when I went on after Equalities in the Home Office to international development, and I spent a lot of time, almost 2 years in Africa, going virtually every week. And I remember I'd be driving along in a chauffeur-driven car with a flag waving on it and watching the sheer poverty of kids and adults sitting on the side of the road with nothing to do, no facilities, no pavements, no curbs, no water. And I would literally go along thinking the serendipity of where you're born and who you're born to is beyond comprehension, really. And I found when I came back from that 2 years as international development minister that I couldn't really ever get across to people what poverty in Africa was like as opposed to relative poverty in this country. And you can't make everything right for everybody, and you can't do it all the time, but you can make sure that they are equal before the law, and that anything they can and want to do can't be stopped by prejudice or discrimination. So I guess, and it's very deep-seated, I was always trying to help people and sort things out from the age of about nine.
So. Really? Where did it come from, do you think?
I have no idea, because my parents, you know, my mum left school at 12. She just got, you know, it was about working and earning a living because my grandparents were dirt poor. I mean, I'm very happy, middle class, you know, reasonably comfortable now. So it didn't come from that. I mean, they were nice parents, although parents were more distant from their children than I am, say, from my children.
Who right.
Overshare with me, in my view. But I just had this sense of right and wrong. And I guess, because I was a designer for 20 years, and I did loads and loads of voluntary work before I started work. You know, at the age of 13, I was a disc jockey in a hospital radio station. And then later on, I visited old people, whether they wanted me to visit them or not.
I did that.
That was a school thing.
Yeah.
And then later, I volunteered at the Royal Free Hospital in London to just hold people's hands if they had no relatives, sit with people who were dying. You know, always wanted to sort things out and make things a bit better. And where it came from, no idea. Just always was there.
It's quite specific, though, actually actively wanting to make things better rather than just to sort of comfort people in the here and now. But this, I get the sense that maybe you had a drive.
Clearly I did, but yeah. Where it came from, I have no idea. And it's funny because I was a designer for 20 years. I had my own small design company. Really fantastic, really enjoyable. It was the age of design then. Everything was happening and it was very exciting. But after 20 years of doing very beautiful work, but really ultimately you're making someone's bottom line do better.
Right.
It wasn't enough. And I decided to join a political party.
Although design is also a creative way of making things better.
Yeah, and it's about sending out a message and making, but in the end, it was mainly for business. It wasn't for social benefit. It was so businesses were more attractive to their clients. The odd record cover, but mainly business. Oh, but nice business, you know, architects and transport planners and
those things make people's lives better. The built environment.
It was a nice world to work in, full of really thoughtful people. Who work very hard to make things nicer, look nicer, be nicer, live in nicer. And I'm sure because when I first became a councillor on Haringey Council, I used to worry endlessly about space standards, which, well, because on all the estates and stuff, the council housing, yeah. You know, the bedrooms were tiny. Now, it's fine when you have a baby, but when you have a 15-year-old boy who needs to do his homework or have friends over, he's going to hang out outside and get into all sorts. You know, so I always felt the built environment lifted people's eyes from their daily grind and their own circumstances. So, you know.
I think that's very interesting. We had another guest on the podcast, actually, who was an architect. I'd talked a lot about the values that the built environment conveyed. And you've said quite a bit even in that, you know, because there you're talking about giving people space, giving space for family life, giving access to those spaces to people who can't on their own financial resources afford it. You're talking about social housing.
Quality and the quality of, you know, sometimes bad design costs as much as good design. I was married to an architect for about 20 years at one point in my life. No, and you see the difference it makes, and the architecture changed because it became developer led, you know, over my lifetime. It used to be a profession, but now you jump to a developer's tune and they cut all the corners that they can cut.
Do you believe in professionalism then? You believe in professionalism?
Yeah, I absolutely do. And I think it was a really important strata of society for people had pride in their output, whether it was as a lawyer or as an architect or whatever, that professional standard came from inside the person, not like religion. That's a whole other thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Your own personal standards, your own personal knowledge of right and wrong. And it still exists. It's just it's not cultivated and it's been squished by the avarice of the commercial world, put it that way.
Right. In this specific example, it's commerce that's crushed the individual integrity.
Particularly with architecture, developers, almost everything is developer-led now. I mean, you'll get these rare architects like Richard Rogers or Norman Foster or, you know, the great buildings. But if you go back to 40, 50 years and the architects then, they had visions and they created worlds and they gave people aspirations. And I think all that stuff is really important. So I'm just an old-fashioned girl.
Well, I hope there's some future in that as well. I hope it's not just confined to the past, that attitude.
I hope so, but you get worn down by the reductionist way we're treated. I mean, I think, you know, I exist in the political media, which is hardly the nicest of environments. And everything is reductionist or footballization, and it's then compounded by the media in this country. We're the lowest common denominator, and if you can shout hate, then you'll get more clicks or reads or whatever. And I think it's just terrible. So
there's a long list of things there which you seem to think are confining and constraining the individual.
Yeah.
Is that an important part of your
worldview?
Absolutely
is. Well, hello, I'm a liberal.
Yeah. Okay. Let's come on to that then. That's your liberalism, is it? Yeah.
It is very, very deep. I mean, when I decided to join a political party, I didn't come from a political background. I mean, my mother was a communist when she was 17, but later probably into that right of Margaret Thatcher.
Right.
She died.
That seems to happen to a lot of communists.
She died just after I joined the Liberal Democrats. And the day I joined, I came home, I was looking after her. She was in late stages of cancer. I said, I've joined a political party. And she said, which one? And I said, the Liberal Democrats. And she went, had she lived, she would have dined out on me now. But yes. She didn't. She never saw any of it. Hmm. So, but I think liberalism, so when I was looking to join, because I didn't come from a political background, I got everybody's manifestos and I read them all. And you know, there's a tiny bit of conservatism in me, very tiny, but just wasn't my kind of thing. Policy-wise, I could see a lot similar with Labour, but I'm never try and command and control me. I just hate centralised control. I think the human spirit is there to be inventive and to roam free, within confines of behaviour and the law, obviously. Sure. You know, but nevertheless, don't try and reduce people to common denominators. So obviously when I read, there was two lines in the Liberal, it's the preamble to the Constitution, and it says, no one shall be enslaved by ignorance, poverty, or conformity.
Conformity, it's a brilliant line.
Thought,
yeah.
Bingo. I thought, there I am.
It could have come right out of John Stuart Mill, that really, couldn't it?
Yeah.
It's such a wonderful thing. And I think, you know, every humanist is at least to some extent a liberal, I think. I mean,
must be something in there, yeah.
Yeah, part of, whether not in, you know, party political terms, but in instincts and so on.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
There's that wonderful bit in On Liberty where John Stuart Mill says the human being's not a machine, you know, built for a purpose to be, you know, designed and run automatically.
Or I need that purpose.
Yeah, but it's a tree, you know, that grows with its own.
And, you know, what I see, you know, happening in schools, for example, the conformity that is taught, I find really damaging. I mean, I'm never allowed to speak about education in my party because I would go much further, to enable teaching to be all about enabling children to be themselves and be the best they can be. And I couldn't care less about their exams and things. And our world doesn't work like that anymore at all. You have to get things now. You have to be qualified. And
so you're talking more about individual personal development in whatever direction.
Yes, you know, I see talents, you know, being fed into a sort of sausage machine of exams. And if you get your... whatever you do at 11 now, I've got no idea, to get into the next school, and then you do your O's and, well, not O's and A's anymore, but your GCSEs and your A-levels. And then you get to university and you get a foot in the law firm when you leave university. It doesn't make you a good lawyer because you haven't developed as a human being. And if you haven't got the perspective to understand many things, then you'll be limited, and what you can do will be limited. So
That's a view of the human being and their needs, which is not very present in politics at the moment, it seems to me at least.
No, I'm often the lone voice in debates, and people laugh at me or ridicule me for being an idealist, and I say, so what? because we have same-sex marriage, and back then it wasn't on the agenda, but because I am who I am, on that a talk by Michael Heseltine and Andrew Adonis, I thought, who basically said, you'll be a busy minister, because us Lib Dem ministers didn't know what we were doing, because we hadn't got any predecessors. And this lecture put on by the Institute of Government with these two great beasts of politics, one Tory, one Labour. Heseltine said, think of something you want to do and focus on it relentlessly. Otherwise, you'll spend 5 years as a minister and achieve nothing. Andrew Adonis said, trust your civil servants. It's not like Yes Minister, although it was exactly like Yes Minister. but if you trust your civil servants, they'll go to the ends of the earth to you. And literally walking back from the Institute of Government to the Home Office, I was thinking, what could be my thing? And same-sex marriage popped into my mind because, as I said earlier in the interview, I always felt civil partnerships were amazing, but they weren't equality. And it popped into my head, and I got back to the Home Office, and I had a private, well, I had lots of private secretaries. Suddenly I had staff, who knew? And I said, how do I do same-sex marriage? Because it's not in anyone's manifesto, and it's not in the coalition agreement. And he said, well, Minister, and the rest is history. And but that's how, you know, that's how it happened. But if I'd been a rule follower, I might not have done that.
And you also said something interesting at the time and since about same-sex marriage, that you felt yourself very much being the latest in the line of people who, you know, fought this cause.
People have fought and died for this. People have suffered hideous, brutal attacks, physical, outcast from their families. They're the ones who deserve all the credit. But I walked in to be a government minister at a moment in time, went to this talk and thought, oh, that needs doing. That's an inequality I'll have a go at. So I just literally stood on the shoulders of giants. But it wasn't marriage, you see. I don't care if people get married or not. I want them to have the right to get married, you know. Or sometimes I say, well, people say, why? And I say, well, I'm a bitter divorcee, and why should gay people not be divorced? No. You know, I was in the right place at the right time and the right person to suddenly have those thoughts. There had not been a liberal in government for a while, and it all worked out. And I suppose it was a kind of, for me, it was a bit of a demonstration of the people will come. Because when I started as a Lib Dem trying to do this pretty impossible thing, I clearly wasn't going to be able to do it on my own. So it was about winning friends and influencing people and making everyone feel they were more important than me.
Well, as being around at the time, actually, I remember it was a very powerful moment for bringing together people who had been disparate for about 20 years or more. You know, lots of different campaigns. Hugh Kelvis had the Equal Marriage campaign. Yeah. You know, everybody else from Human Rights.
They coalesced. I think.
That's not common.
But I think it's also because I said I met everybody. You know, I went to meet everyone, called everyone in, and you know, Ben Summerskill was dubious. Would be a nice way of pushing it. But I said to them, look, I think I see an opportunity to get this through, but I can't do it without you. And that was entirely true. And so they all had this amazing part to play, you know, from Benjamin Cohen at Pink News,
yes.
Stonewall came on board, Michael Cashman, and what's the other one called? Dumbledore, was he? Oh, you know, the actor.
Ian McKellen.
Ian McKellen on the wall there. Everyone stepped in. The religious organisations, the pro-marriage.
Yeah, the Quakers, the liberal Jews.
The Episcopalians.
No, it was
everyone had a part to play. And the organised religions, the great organised religions of the world, rose up against them.
Yep.
It. Yeah.
You talked earlier on about the role of chance and serendipity, and obviously you're the right place, right person, the right time. And you've talked about believing in, you know, the long line of people who'd campaign for something, and you were just the latest in the campaign. But there is also a question of personal leadership. I mean, many other people in the right place at the right time wouldn't have been the right person. So, I mean, you should take your credit. But also, I wonder what you think about that concept of political leadership. Because, you know, same-sex marriage was not, and this is another aspect of it, same-sex marriage was not something that the majority of the public supported before it became law. Then after it became law, of course, people did start to support it. But
yeah, no,
it took leadership to make that happen.
Do you know, I always think if someone's really convinced of something, they're very convincing. I just used to talk to people as I'm talking to you, and either they agreed with me or they didn't. There were plenty who didn't. It's not as if I had 100% success rate. I had quite a hard time, quite a lot of threats.
Sure. Well, that's the common to this, isn't it?
It does fit in with my notion that... I think it was the same reason I overturned a 26,000 Labour majority in the seat that I won over two elections when everyone said it couldn't be done.
Right.
Just, I think people meet you and they think if you're genuine and you're prepared to work hard, they're prepared to believe you and work with you.
And they that's the notion you have of the importance of personal connection?
I don't know. Other people would have to answer that, but right. I am who I am, and I clearly have been very persuasive. And, you know, I mean, I didn't realize till later in life or very lately that I am persuasive and can be very charming when I put my mind to it. But don't talk to my children about that.
That's an interesting realization to have later in life.
Yeah, I was not born confident or anything like that. So, in fact, always had imposter syndrome. To a great extent, because I didn't come from a family that sent people to university or did anything public, you know. So,
is that part of your antipathy to conformity? Do you think that's where it comes from, the fact that you weren't from a standard background?
No, because I didn't conform to what my parents wanted.
You didn't conform to anything.
I was very anti everything they stood for.
So, classic liberal.
I was just born with it, really. You know.
When you left your seat in 2015, your last email to constituents was about the ongoing need for a liberal voice in politics.
Yeah.
You've spoken a little bit about what the content of that liberalism is for you. Yeah. What are the bits of that liberalism that you feel strongest about and that are currently not present, do you think, in the public debate?
Oh, almost all of it. I mean, it's just so depressing at the moment. I can't tell you how glad I am not to be in the House of Commons at the moment. I just feel that the freedom, it's not really freedom of expression or freedom of speech, because I think we have that. It's the way it's being manipulated into hatred of other. And... It's an abuse of free speech, really, I think. Mm. I mean, the newspapers say, let us be free, let us be free. You know, they didn't want, what was it called? Leveson. Leveson 2. They don't want any curtailment of their power for free speech. And yet they use their speech in a way which I would regard as contravening our laws. I think it's prejudicial and, downright hate stirring.
It's
and also quite
position.
A lot untrue.
Yeah, well, that's important, isn't it? Because it's a difficult position for a liberal to be in. I don't know if you feel this way. When you start to talk about, for example, regulating the press or regulating expression.
Are regulated. We don't have complete free speech anyway. And, you know, you kind of know where the boundaries are. Well, I can tell without laws where the boundaries are.
Yeah. Where would you put the boundaries?
Well, be free to be whoever you want to be, say whatever you want, so long as you don't really hurt anybody.
Right. Exactly. So that's quite a classic liberal position, but I guess it's running into, I mean, that's my position too. That's what I always say, and what Hugh Shigeo always says.
We've got trouble and difficulty at the moment on things like the trans issue and stuff.
Well, that's so multifaceted that.
But it's complex, and people don't seem to give any credence to the complexity of what's happening to people who are trans. They just want to hate them because of a tiny minority of instance compared to male violence against women. It's just ridiculous that all these people are spending all this time chasing the wrong villain, if you like.
It
shows a total lack. I mean, do people really think that 250,000 people have suddenly decided they want to change sex so that they can go into women's toilets and hurt women? I mean, it's just the most absurd idea. And it's not beyond the wit of man or woman to devise cubicles or whatever is necessary. It's also, from my point of view, I took the Equality Act through for the Lib Dems in between 2005 and 2010.
Yes.
And I can remember arguing in committee very vocally, even though I didn't really know what I was doing half the time, because when you first do legislation, there's strange language and a lot of bits of paper.
Yeah.
References to acts before amendments in other acts and so on.
Yeah.
And I remember making the point to the minister that the term gender reassignment was very misleading because it kind of implied you had to take hormones or you had to have done something really serious for it to be considered gender reassignment. Mm. And because of the words I put around it, which was the explanation that it was a spectrum, and people were at different places on the spectrum, and her agreement and her words in committee that it didn't mean that you'd had to have surgery or you had to do that everyone on that spectrum is protected in law. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is the LSE very kindly named a moot after me. It's called the LSE Featherstone LGBT plus moot. Oh. And do you know what a moot is?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay, well, not, I didn't when they asked me.
Oh, really?
Anyway, it was only meant to run for a year. It's in its sixth year now. And it chooses a difficult LGBT issue.
Maybe we should explain, actually, for listeners who don't know what a moot is. So it's a sort of legal debate.
Law students from all over the country come and they're set a problem.
Yeah.
On which there's right on both sides, would be the point.
An arguable problem.
It's a moot point.
Yeah, exactly.
And an example of that, which many people will have heard of, would be the gay cake, where a Christian bakers refused and it was ruled one way in the court and then overruled in the court. And you had a clash of rights. Okay. So the last few years, there has been a trans case has come as the moot argument for students. And it is intensely interesting. One was a women-only club of some sort, maybe a swimming club or something. I can't remember the cases now, but they were both very fine lines. And that is the whole point, is this is new territory. We all need to be tolerant of each other and look at it properly. And it is decided by case law as it progresses how to work out where right and wrong and which side of the line and where the dividing line should be. But the way it has been whipped up by the media and people who like to hate is all I can think, as if it's some simple thing that you can't do this and you can do that and you can't do that. It's so much more complicated. So obviously I take the liberal view that if you're not hurting anyone and if you're a trans woman and you go to the toilet, I couldn't care less if you go to the toilet with me. Mm. I accept there are other women who feel differently. The women's refuges are making their individual decisions about how to accommodate.
Which the Act allows, yes, exactly.
Which the Act allows. Mm. It also allows exemptions when there's a vulnerability. Clearly, the Isla Bryce case where they put a trans woman, a belatedly trans woman after two male rapes into a female prison was an absurdity. So people need to understand better how to use their heads and their own judgment. And that's my phone.
Someone doesn't want you talking about this case. So you're taking aim there against the prejudice aspect of this, that because there's discrimination there and you're against that, but you're also taking aim at the simplification that's going on because there's complexity here and you believe that complexity has to be taken into account.
Absolutely. And that desire to make it you're with us or against us is ending right now, and people killing themselves, being killed, and now it's moving on to the LGB community. I mean, it's also driven by a lot of money coming in from the evangelical and moral majority in America, who see it as a wedge issue. And if you look in America, I mean, they're beginning to ban trans children from schools. LGB rights roll back. We've lost the right to abortion in America. You can see, if you open your eyes, that this is not just about the minuscule amount of trans people, let alone the minuscule bit who have transgressed and should face the penalties for a crime. You know, you're not a criminal just for going to the toilet if you are a trans woman. You're a criminal if you attack somebody.
Fighting against the injustice of inequality, having your own personal standards, optimism, creativity, complexity, and never conformity, and making things better. Thank you, Lynn, for telling us what you believe.
Pleasure.
What I Believe is a weekly podcast from Humanist UK. We'll be releasing new episodes every Thursday. If you'd like to support the podcast, find out more about humanism, Humanist UK, and the work that we do, you can find out more on the Humanist UK website, humanists.uk. And if you like what you see, please consider signing up as a member or a supporter. You can also find out more about humanism by purchasing the Sunday Times bestseller, The Little Book of Humanism, available at all good bookshops.